a teacher in fifth grade whose name was Mr. Scott. He's not alive anymore. To be candid, I don't remember the name of my third or fourth grade teacher, but I vividly remember my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Scott. I don't even remember my sixth or my seventh either, so it's not like it was a function of time. There was something about him that was particularly unique. I remember I had a very difficult fifth grade. I was in public school. I went to public school all the way till I graduated high school. And I was 2 years ahead in terms of age there. And I'm about average height. I think most of you know that. But when you're 2 years behind, especially as a little boy, you're going to basically always be the smallest boy in the class. And so I was picked on incessantly for being the smallest boy in the class. And on top of that, one ugly day, my school didn't have a lot of ethnic diversity either. And I was the darkest person in my class. I had dark skin. And so I got a lot of the N-word thrown my way one day. And this toxic combination led me to, in a very discreet way, just put my head down on my desk and cry. I didn't want anybody to see me, but I cried. And I was trying my very, very best to not let anybody see me, because of course, if you're the littlest kid in the class, you don't want to also be known as the one who's crying, right? That's like even worse. And I remember Mr. Scott saw me in the corner of his eye, and he came up to me and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he just genuinely cared for me. And he took such an interest in me over the course of that year, where almost nobody did, that I felt like I didn't have a lot of people to turn to except for Mr. Scott. In the midst of my fifth grade struggles, I will always be grateful to him for how he cared for me and how he believed in me. Many of us have probably had, at some point in our life, a teacher who has made an impact on your life. Actually, I'd be curious, is there a teacher, you can raise your hand, is there a teacher you've had in your life that like you can look back at and you think, like, wow, that person really made, okay, so like half of the hands roughly have gone up. I really do think that, at least in my case, had it not been for Mr. Scott, I would have been a worse person. I'm going to be talking in today's session about the ministry of teaching. And this applies at many, many levels to basically everybody in the room. It applies to you, certainly if you're a parent, because you've got to teach your children. So if you're a father or mother, this is going to be a very relevant message. Certainly if you're a church leader or one day going to be a church leader. But frankly, anybody who is going to be influencing someone in some way, I think you're going to find this to be a relevant message. The word is used a lot in the Bible. The word teacher is used a lot. Didaskalos is the Greek word. Jesus is called a teacher a lot. In fact, if you count, Jesus is directly addressed about 90 times, 90 times in the New Testament. And in these direct addresses, out of the 90 times, 60 times, the title that is given to him is teacher. Okay? So if you go back and look at, for example, when Nicodemus talks to Jesus, he refers to him as teacher. When the Pharisees go to Jesus, they call him teacher. It seems to be the title that others use for him. Now, interestingly, Jesus doesn't choose that for himself. He prefers the title Son of Man. That's a different topic. But when others come to him, they use the word teacher. And we're going to drill down into this word. So what I want to do is a little exercise here. And this is hopefully fairly obvious, but in English and in all languages, words often come in pairs. Okay, so for example, doctor, patient. That's a pair, right? Lawyer, client. Okay, shopkeeper. What's the opposite of shopkeeper, or the pair word of shopkeeper? Yeah, customer. Coach, player, driver, passenger, mother, yeah, child, master, slave. Yeah, so pretty straightforward. What is the pair word for teacher? Student, right. So that is absolutely true in English. However, it is not true in the Bible. And I want you to kind of be astonished for a moment, and I'm going to go through a number of scriptures, and I really hope you take notes, because this is a very important message here. Let's look at Matthew chapter 10, verse 24. And like I said, we're going to look at a bunch of scriptures here, but I want us to set our eyes on a few of them ourselves. So in Matthew chapter 10, verse 24, we see how the Bible uses the pair word for teacher. So in Matthew 10, 24, Jesus is speaking, and he says, "A disciple is not above his teacher." Whoa, isn't that interesting? So in Jesus's description, the pair word for teacher, didaskalos, is the word disciple or mathetes. In English, we all said for good reason, student or pupil, not disciple. But in the biblical lexicon, in the biblical verbiage, teacher is equivalent to discipler. Okay? Teacher is equivalent to discipler. This is why, and this is a passage that I quote a lot at Sattler, it's Luke 6:40, where Jesus says, "Everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher." Okay, that makes sense if you think about it in the context of everybody, when he's fully trained, will be like his discipler. The discipler is the one who's forming the person. This also begins to explain verses like this. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 19, somebody comes to Jesus and says, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Now, when I think of a teacher, I think of like somebody with a piece of chalk writing on a chalkboard, standing in front of a classroom, and they're writing out multiplication tables or something like that. You would not go to your grade school teacher and say, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." That doesn't make any sense. But you would say that if, in your mind, the word teacher is more like discipler, or the person who is forming me. So what has happened in terms of the way this word has been used over time? What has happened in slow but subtle ways over the centuries is that our concept of teacher has moved from being more the biblical Hebraic sense to more of a Hellenistic or Greek sense. Our sense of the teacher is mostly somebody who imparts ideas. Right? I teach classes at Sattler, and frankly, I kind of think of myself as that. I deliver ideas when I teach immunology or whatever the class is. I want people to know and understand the ideas of immunology. There is a term that captures the way that we think of teachers today, and I think it's a helpful term. The term is ideological. Ideological is basically the privileging of ideas. It's particularly the privileging of ideas in a way that is less emphasizing the people. I'm going to read to you here from a book where the authors say this: "The teaching ministry in the Bible, as the Bible intends it, is more inclined to be oriented toward life and obedience than toward ideas divorced from life and context." He goes on to say, they go on to say, "For biblical teacher, their lives are to be their primary messages, and they speak with the authority of people who can live what they speak. These are the true rabbis. Teaching is not about speculation of ideas in themselves, idealism. It is rather about the ministry of ideas in action, ethos, that is discipleship or formation. We cannot teach what we do not know, and we cannot lead where we will not go. Therefore, biblical teachers must have real participation in the ideas they propose." In the more Hellenistic or Western concept, in this ideological framework that we have, where ideas are privileged and the teacher word has sort of grabbed onto that locus, where ideas are primarily how you are assessed. Okay, so to again use the analogy of a college here, they judge you on how well students do on tests and how well people do well with respect to the MCAT or the GRE. And it's a lot of idea-based evaluation of how people are doing. It's not as much a people way of assessing others. Okay, so from Matthew 10, we learn the pair word in the Bible for teacher is actually disciple, so we can rethink of teacher as discipler. I want you to look at this with me. Look at John chapter 1:38. We're actually going to look at two places in John where John goes out of his way to fill us in on something. John 1:38, it says, "Then Jesus turned and seeing them following, said to them, 'What do you seek?' They said to him, 'Rabbi,' which is to say, when translated, 'Teacher,' 'where are you staying?'" Okay, the details aren't that important here, but I want you to notice that John says, hey, whenever you hear the word rabbi, I want you to know, and he actually writes it out, that's not from the interpreters here, that's literally what it says in the original language, rabbi when translated teacher. He wants you to know that teacher and rabbi are the same thing. And just in case you're slow at learning that, if you look at the end of the book, look at John chapter 20, verse 16. John chapter 20, verse 16, this is right after the resurrection. Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him, "Rabboni," which is to say, teacher. Okay? So John is like, hey, you get it? I want you to know that this word rabbi, in case you missed it at the beginning of my book, this word rabbi or rabboni is the same thing as teacher. This is the first title, actually, that Jesus gets after the resurrection. And I think it makes sense that Mary would say this as a term of endearment. She's the first person to see the risen Jesus, and she clings to him as in, my disciple or my rabbi, you're the one who's shaped me, you're the one who's made me. You're not the one who was standing there on the chalkboard teaching me math facts, you're the one who shaped me and made me the person that I am. Okay, so we have now, in the New Testament, two words that we can treat as synonymous with teacher, discipler and rabbi. We're going to get a third one in a moment, but before we get to that, I want us to look at a verse that I have been studying incessantly for the last 6 months or so. It's 1 Corinthians 12, verse 28. 1 Corinthians 12:28 is a very important passage to describe how the church should be governed. This is the New King James. "And God has appointed these in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, after that miracles, then gifts of healing, helps, administrations, varieties of tongues." Okay, so notice here that who is the one who's appointing these in the church? He doesn't say, "And I appoint these in the church." Paul doesn't appoint these. God is the one who is appointing these in the church. This is God's structure here, not any humans. And there's an order here, first, second, third. This is not some haphazard list here. And he says, apostles, prophets, teachers. Okay, so there's these three roles, these three offices here. And I think the first, second, third suggests that this is not random, but that there's an order and a purpose to it. Okay, but notice how teachers are on the list. Okay, teachers are right there on the list. Lord willing, in my next citywide, I want to talk about prophets. I'm not going to do that today, so we can save that for next time, but I'm going to focus here on teachers. Okay, so let's look at another familiar passage. Many of you have looked at this together with us over the years. It's Ephesians 4, verses 11 to 14, and I'm actually going to read it in the ESV, not the New King James here. Ephesians 4, verses 11 to 14. "And he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children, tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by cunning, by craftiness, and deceitful schemes. Okay, so you should want to compare these two lists. So in 1 Corinthians 12:28, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, right? Here, there are seemingly five elements on the list, five members of the list, and it's apostles, prophets, evangelists, shepherds, teachers. Well, I think we can actually very nicely harmonize these two, first by recognizing the main ministry of evangelists is outside of the church, right? Evangelists should be winning the lost. And so they're not really appointed in the church. So we can remove the E, because in 1 Corinthians 12:28, Paul is saying in the church. So let's focus on in the church today. I'm not saying we remove evangelists and the necessity. I'm saying that for our purposes today, we're talking about in the church. So evangelists are out of the church. So that leaves us with APST. And if you have an ESV, you should notice a footnote on verse 11. Does anybody have an ESV and can say loudly what that footnote says? Yeah, or pastors. So pastors is the other word for shepherds. And I think depending on which edition of the ESV, there's a second footnote. Yeah, the other, and so I think there's slightly different editions of the ESV, but some editions of the ESV will say, or shepherd-teachers. Okay, why would they do that? They would do that because there's, in fact, only four definite articles in the list. Okay, what is the definite article in English? The, right? The apple, the podium. So in this list here, there's only four articles, one in front of apostles, one in front of prophets, one in front of evangelists, and one in front of shepherds and teachers. And for complicated reasons we're not going to get into now, I would say many, if not most, Greek grammarians argue that that last group is actually the same group being identified by slightly different terms. So shepherd-teachers there. So if you go with that, all of a sudden we have perfect harmony between the lists, right? We have apostles first, then prophets, the evangelists are working out of the church, and then these shepherd-teachers. What we gain by doing this is that teacher, because there's only one definite article in front of that, is closely identified with shepherds. Okay? Teacher is closely identified with shepherds. So, my first point that I've taken a long time to make is that teacher is one of the three canonical offices of the New Testament church, and it has three other words you can use to describe it. Discipler, rabbi, or shepherd. Okay? So teacher is one of these three canonical offices in the church and has different names. There's fluidity of nomenclature. We can also call it discipler, rabbi, or shepherd. Okay, that's my first point. Now we're going to take a little bit of a dive into how the Pauline churches were established. A lot of you know that the very first missionary journey that Paul takes, he goes into the interior of Turkey, and he goes into Pisidian Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe. He goes into these cities. That area is known as Galatia. And then he goes back to Syrian Antioch, where he started his journey from, and he writes his very first letter that we have in the New Testament, which is the book of Galatians. And Galatians is written to the churches in that area of Turkey. And I will be the first to say the main point of Galatians is not about church leadership. It's about circumcision and covenants and things like that. We're not going to get into that today. But there's a very interesting little side note that Paul gives us in Galatians 6:6. So look at this. Look at Galatians 6:6 with me. Galatians 6:6 is written only a matter of months after he has started and established these brand new churches there. So it's very, very early. Galatians 6:6 says, Let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. It's easy to read over that quickly, but I'm fascinated by this. I'm fascinated by this because here in Galatians, what Paul is telling us is that apparently there are people who are teaching the word, and the expectation is that those who are taught the word are supposed to share in all good things. Now, I will say here, virtually everybody, ancient and modern, agrees that sharing all good things implies some kind of material support or financial support. In some circles, that's kind of like unacceptable, but that is the consensus of ancient and modern interpreters here, and I think it makes sense. So this teaching ministry that Paul has apparently already established is one that is intense enough that Paul wants there to be a relationship of support, in this case, financial support, back to those who are doing the teaching. He wants there to be this material and financial support. Now, let's look at the next oldest letter of Paul, which is 1 Thessalonians. So you can turn to 1 Thessalonians now. While you're turning there, let me just remind you that in his second missionary journey, he goes from Asia Minor into Macedonia. And when he gets to Macedonia, the capital of Macedonia is Thessalonica. And he is there for a very short time because there's a riot that happens at someone named Jason's house. And people are chanting outside of Jason's house. And he has to flee under duress. He's only in Thessalonica for a few weeks, maybe a couple of months at the longest. I checked a few study Bibles, and they're in that range, either a few weeks or a couple of months, so not a lot of time. And then what he does is he goes just a little bit south to Corinth, which is in modern-day Greece, and he writes 1 Thessalonians to them very soon after he was just there. Okay, so look at 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 to 13. In 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 to 13, Paul says this. This is the New King James. And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves. Okay, so here Paul is saying he urges them. He's like, please do this, to recognize those who labor among you. So apparently there's a group of people that have already, this early, just weeks after they've been started, who are laboring among them, that who are over them in the Lord, and who are admonishing. They're putting to practice biblical admonishment. And he's telling them to recognize them and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake. And then he says, be at peace among yourself. Now, he doesn't use the word teacher here, but this sure sounds like a teaching, discipling ministry. They're laboring, they're admonishing. As we've seen, this word teacher is not a rigid term. There's other synonyms that can be used for it. And it, at the very least, we know that there are a group of people that are appointed within weeks of his being there who are laboring and admonishing and having this type of ministry there. In exchange for their labors, they are supposed to receive recognition, is the word the New King James uses, and to be esteemed very highly in love. And I find it interesting that the next verse he says, be at peace among yourselves. He seems to be saying, if you do this, this will bring peace among you. And the implication is that if you don't, there will be unrest and division. Okay, so based on what we see from Galatians and Thessalonians, these early, early churches of Paul, my second point is that early on, Paul establishes a discipleship infrastructure carried out by teachers who are materially and emotionally supported by the congregation. Okay, so within weeks, perhaps months, you have this group of people. They're called teachers in Galatians. They're called laborers and admonishers in 1 Thessalonians that are working there, that are recognized. And I want to highlight that word for a moment here. And they form this discipling infrastructure that, if we had time to go through 1 Thessalonians more carefully, Paul lays out in much more detail what this ministry of discipleship really looks like. We won't do that now. Okay, I want you to note that the word used in Thessalonians is this word recognized. Now, that word recognized is a word that doesn't have a lot of fanfare, right? Recognize. Oh, yeah, I recognize Erica. I recognize you. In fact, the words that the New Testament uses, particularly about leaders, are quite muted. There are words like recognize, choose, appoint. I did an exercise where I just did an English search in the New King James and the ESV, which are two, I think, of the more popular translations of the Bible. And I just type in the word ordain. And I asked the question, how many times is the word ordain used to describe the selection of leaders in the New Testament in either the New King James or the ESV? And the answer is zero. I was surprised. I thought there would be an example of it. The word is used in other contexts, but it's not actually used about the selecting of New Testament leaders. It is used about priests in the Old Testament, but never used about selecting leaders in the New, at least in those two translations. In fact, there is a lot of focus and attention on this word ordain. That is this like really heavy word, right? Like, are you ordained? You know, and this is like, whoa, are you ordained? And it's just like, it's supposed to like send some kind of like shiver down your spine there. And yet, it's more of a holdover from King James English. But yet, I think we would all say that everybody in the New Testament seemed to know the people who occupied these roles. Okay, we won't turn to these passages, but in 1 Corinthians 14, there's this long section about prophets, right? And the prophets are the ones that are speaking on Sunday's meetings, and they're, you know, Paul tells them one speak and not two at a time, all that. They seem to know who their prophets are, and it's just kind of obvious to them. In Acts 13:1, it mentions prophets and teachers, and it mentions this list of people. This is when they send out Saul and Barnabas on the first missionary journey. And if I were to say to you, you can answer this in your mind, were the prophets and teachers in 1 Corinthians 14 and Acts 13, were they ordained? Were they ordained? Were those prophets and teachers ordained? I'll say, I think most of us would say, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. But if we were to say, were they recognized, I think we would all say, yeah, obviously they're recognized because they're used in the New Testament in a way where everybody knows who they are. Agabus is recognized as a prophet. Philip's daughters are recognized as prophetesses. Like, they're clearly recognized. We have created this kind of a scary word, ordain, that has taken on, let's call it, unbiblical proportions. One of the things that I've observed over the years is that many people have a hyper-focus on the ordination of elders. They're not bothered if prophets are not recognized. No problems there. I'm not opposed to laying on of hands and ceremonies. I think those things have their place and they're wonderful things. But I have a concern that we can go off track from governance because certain words take on more meaning than they're supposed to take. Ask the same people who are very, very concerned about ordination of elders, okay, what do you think about 1 Corinthians 12:28? And God appointed these in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, and you'll probably get a blank stare. My third point is that ordination can become a fetish of legitimization. Ordination can become a fetish of legitimization. I'm gonna use fetish here in a careful way. I don't mean it in a sexual sense. I'll give you the dictionary, some of the dictionary definitions of the word fetish. One dictionary says, an excessive and irrational devotion or commitment to a particular thing. Another definition, an inanimate object worshipped for its supposed magical powers or because it is considered to be inhabited by a spirit. Again, at least in the New King James and the ESV, these words are not used about the selection of leaders. How did they get this really, really high importance? We don't even have record. There's not one instance in the New Testament of elders having their hands laid on them. Think about that for a minute. There's not one place where that's even mentioned in the New Testament. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It could well have happened, but there's no record of it. We read into that, and we can make cases for it. And again, I'm not opposed to it. Please don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying those things are wrong. What I'm opposed to is when certain words become fetishized and we lose the spirit of what is intended by the New Testament, which is more simple, ordinary words, recognize, choose, things like that. That is the sense in which we see the words that are selected by the inspired writers of the New Testament. In the business world, if I appoint someone to be a manager or to oversee a project, people take it seriously. Nobody needs a ceremony. I don't need to put my hands on top of them. They're going to do it. It's going to get done. But in the church, we have this, I think, fetishization that has happened there. All right. Let's now look at 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 5 to 7. First Timothy 2:5-7, reading here for the New King James, says, "For there is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ, who gave himself a ransom for all to be testified in due time, for which I was appointed a preacher and an apostle. I am speaking the truth in Christ and not lying, a teacher of the Gentiles in faith and truth." Okay, so what is going on here? This is a very interesting passage that people can read over quickly. Do you notice here how Paul actually gives himself three titles? Does everybody see what the three are? You can shout them out if you see them. Apostle is one. Preacher. Teacher. Does everybody see that? You see all three? I want you to see with your own eyes. Preacher, I think, is a synonym. Kadux is the synonym of evangelist here. So I think he's identifying himself as having that role. Apostle, of course, everybody thinks about Paul in that sense. But teacher as well. Now, I'm going to contend this isn't just some haphazard incidental comment that he makes. Because turn to 2 Timothy 1:11. Second Timothy 1:11 says, "To which I was appointed a preacher, an apostle, and a teacher of the Gentiles." Anybody notice a similarity there? It's the exact same three again, right? This isn't just some random thing that he's saying. He has the awareness that God has given him a particular vocation, and it's not just apostle. He sees himself as preacher, apostle, and teacher. He views himself as having three roles. So my fourth point is that a person can fulfill multiple roles. I think it is dangerous to sometimes overly compartmentalize here, where there are several examples of this, and if you want, after the meeting, you can come to me and I can give you more examples of this kind of multiple roles. Okay, I'm going to go to my last point now, which is, in some sense, the one that I want to devote the most energy to, hopefully not time, and it is the what of this ministry. What is entailed in this teaching ministry? And again, there's synonyms for it, right? Discipler, what's the second one? Rabbi and shepherd. We can use these words basically interchangeably. I'm going to modify here an outline that I got from somebody named Timothy Whitmer. He's got a really great book on this that I've tweaked a little bit. The first thing that I'm going to say about the what does it mean to be a good teacher? And this applies to you if you are a father, a mother, a teacher, if you have any oversight of anybody who is following you in any kind of spiritual way, which probably most people in the room, most adults in the room, that is true of. And I want to give us four key words to lock in on based on Timothy Whitmer's work here that I think are really helpful. Before I give you those four words about the what of teaching, and again, I think we've been seduced somewhat by the Greco-Roman or Hellenistic notion of teaching, that we've missed the biblical vision of teacher. And the more I have studied this, the more I've just had this breathtaking sense that if we could recover this, it would be a quantum leap forward in ways that we can barely even fathom. I'm going to read to you first, you don't have to turn to this, but I'm going to read to you from Psalm 78. It's a beautiful psalm that highlights these four words, not directly, but indirectly. He also chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. Okay, why do I say this? I say this because, or why do I quote this verse? I quote this verse because every parent here knows how difficult it is to parent. It is really hard. And what this psalm is telling us is that God picked David, and David was able to shepherd according to the integrity of his heart and guide them, the sheep, with his skillful hands. I'm going to say right now, shepherding is really, really hard. Teaching is really, really hard. Being a rabbi is really, really hard. It requires integrity of heart and skill. This is not something that comes natural to probably any of us. Okay, so what are the words that I want to key in on? The first word that I want to key in on is the word know, K-N-O-W. So this is from John 10. It's a very famous passage. I don't think we need to turn to it because we know it, where Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. I know my own and my own know me, even as the Father knows me and I know the Father. Jesus knows the sheep, right? The famous parable about like there's one lost sheep. He knows it, and the shepherd goes off and pursues that one last sheep. There's something about knowing that is bound up with listening, right? Listening is how you know somebody, how you get to know them. It's not by talking to them, it's by listening. I'm going to read to you a quote from Stephen Covey's book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. He tells this vignette, which I think hopefully will sober us a little bit. Covey writes this, a father once told me, I can't understand my kid. He just won't listen to me at all. Let me just restate what you said, I replied. You don't understand your son because he won't listen to you? That's right, he replied. Let me try again, I said. You don't understand your son because he won't listen to you? That's what I said, he impatiently replied. I thought that to understand another person, you needed to listen to him, I suggested. Oh, he said. There was a long pause. Oh, he said again as the light began to dawn. Oh yeah, but I do understand him. I know what he's going through. I went through the same thing myself. I guess what I don't understand is why he won't listen to me. This man didn't have the vaguest idea of what was really going on inside his boy's head. He looked into his own head and thought he saw the world, including his boy. Covey goes on in this excellent section of the book to talk about how there's these different levels of listening. And the worst level, he says, is ignoring. The second level is pretending. And we've all done this, right? Somebody's like talking and and you're like, you're trying to like make them think that you're listening, but you're really not. And then there's selective listening where you're on your phone and you're like, or on your computer or something, and you're like catching little bits here and there, which can be really dangerous, and you can make yourself be really foolish if you talk too much in that setting. Then there's attentive listening, okay, where you're actually listening, but then he describes the highest level as empathetic listening. And it's a great word, empathetic listening. Those words, there's three words, empathy, sympathy, and compassion. They all mean the same thing at the root level. They all mean to suffer with someone. And I love those words. My dad, when I was young, he used to give a sermon often when we would travel around when we were raising support for the Bible College. And he has this great sermon about Jesus, how Jesus was moved with compassion. That word compassion Splagnitsume is the word that is only used either about Jesus or in Jesus' mouth all throughout the Gospels. Only out of Jesus' mouth or about Jesus. And it's what moves Jesus into action. It's kind of this word that whenever you see compassion, you know that something dramatic is going to happen. We have, as parents, Laura and I have been really trying and pushing into this in our own parenting. And I'm convinced that one of the most effective ways to create gains in your parenting or in your relationships, your friendships, is to become an empathetic listener. And often that alone will bring them to a better place. I remember when I was in graduate school, I was going through a really hard time with some things I won't get into now, but I was going through a really hard time, and there was a staff worker with InterVarsity, and he's about maybe 15 years older than me, and he said, "Hey, Finney, can I take you out to pizza?" And I said, "Sure," and he took me out to pizza, and right in Harvard Square, and I remember he said, "Hey, just tell me what's going on," and I talked to him, and I was telling my story, and he started to bawl. He was bawling in this pizza store, and I was so moved. I remember thinking, wow, here's this like older guy who like is just heartbroken over my struggles here. And I'll never forget that moment. It was just, it's burned into my brain as this older man was just crying and crying as he just heard my struggles. Okay, so the first word I said was no, right? The first word about what teachers, what shepherds, what rabbis are supposed to be doing is no. The second word is the word feed. The word feed. Now, this is a classic passage that I think we should probably look at here. So turn to Ezekiel 34. This is probably the classic passage whenever you hear the word feed, you should think about. Hopefully, some of you already thought of this passage in Ezekiel 34. I'll read from verses 7 to 10, and then 14 and 15. It says this, "Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As I live, says the Lord God, surely because my flock became a prey, and my flock became food for every beast of the field, because there was no shepherd, nor did my shepherds search for my flock, but the shepherds fed themselves and did not feed my flock. Therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require them. I require my flock at their hand." And then down in verse 14, "I will feed them in a good pasture, and their grazing ground will be on the mountain heights of Israel. There they will lie down on good grazing ground and feed in rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I will feed my flock, and I will lead them to rest, declares the Lord God." Okay, so the shepherds are indicted in Ezekiel here, and this passage, as I said, is kind of the signature passage when you think about feeding here. What are the shepherds doing instead of feeding the flock? Can you speak up? Yeah, they're feeding themselves. And because they're feeding themselves, God says, "I am against them." God says, "I am against the shepherds." And he says, "I'm going to do the feeding because the shepherds are failing." Now, I think one of the key points to remember with this is we often think of teaching as being a group activity. And it is. So people will say, "Oh, you're teaching right now." Okay, that's true. But there's macro teaching and there's micro teaching. There's teaching at the group level, and there's also, we can call it different names, teaching, counseling, mentoring, whatever you want to say, where we are imparting the word of God at a micro level, individually, one-on-one. And one of the key ideas in shepherding is it's both corporate and individual at the same time. You're both in charge of the whole flock, but you're also responsible for individuals. It's both macro and micro at the same time. And I think, generally speaking, teaching has become more of a macro enterprise, and we have forgotten the one-on-one discipleship type work that is supposed to be embodied in this teaching ministry. We are supposed to be feeding one another with God's instruction, with God's counsel. Parents to children, brothers to sisters, spiritually and biologically. It is supposed to be systematic and complete too. When David says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." That's kind of old-fashioned English, but what does that mean? I shall not want. Yeah, I'm not going to miss anything. I'm complete. I don't lack anything. Paul in Acts 20 says, "I'm innocent of your blood because I gave you the whole counsel of God." Feeding at its heart is supposed to be complete. You know, if you're missing certain nutrients in the diet, you will die or get sick. It's a lot like that with the teaching ministry of the pulpit at the macro level as well as at the micro level. Okay, what was our first word on the what? No. And the second word? Feed. All right, the third word is protect. And you're going to see there's kind of a rhythm to this, which hopefully will make it more memorable. So far it's no, feed, protect. So protect here. Also from Acts 20, I'll be brief on this, but Paul, when he is giving his farewell speech to the Ephesian elders, he says, "Be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock, among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. I know that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock." Paul knows that there's going to be threats. He knows that there's going to be wolves that come in and try to tear apart the flock and devour the sheep. And so again, there's macro and micro dimensions of protection. At the macro level, it is, as a teaching ministry, speaking against the cultural dangers that are all around us, speaking and warning against dangerous worldviews, guarding against leaven in the church, incorrect doctrine, church discipline. These are all important at the macro level. But at the micro level, there's also a form of protection. It is very easy for a person to become self-deluded and to miss their own weaknesses and sins and flaws. And there's a protection there that we're supposed to be giving to say, "Hey, don't you know what's going on? Can you see here what's happening to yourself as you are going in this particular direction?" You know, if a sheep were to say to the shepherd, like, "I don't want your protection," it's kind of hard to know what to do, right? It's hard to know what to say at that point. It's so bound up with this ministry of shepherding and teaching and being a rabbi there that to not have protection or to say no to the protection means you're somewhat out of the scope of the shepherd or the teacher. My final, the fourth word is the word lead. Lead, okay? So it's no, feed, protect, lead. That kind of has a nice rhythm to it, right? No, feed, protect, lead. I like it. So those are, I think, the four main practices of what it is to be a teacher or a rabbi or a discipler or a shepherd. This is, of course, the picture that you probably have of Jesus the rabbi walking around Galilee leading the disciples, or a shepherd walking through a field leading his sheep. This also has macro and micro elements. The macro would be vision casting, direction setting. The micro level would be leading individuals. I have a lot more to say on this, but I know this is, I have time constraints here, and so I'm gonna save this for a midweek because there's a lot more I wanna talk about on the leading side. It's too rich to give it, to wanna compress it now. So my fifth and final point is the what of teaching or shepherding or being a rabbi or a discipler is, what are the four words? No, feed, protect, lead. Okay, what a great assessment to use. Right now, all of you who are parents, I want you to think about how you're doing there with respect to your children. In terms of knowing them, feeding them, protecting them, and leading them. Think about this in any area where you have responsibility, maybe with a younger sibling, maybe it's in a Christiformity setting. There's a lot of different ways you can assess yourself according to this Know, feed, protect, lead. Okay, so to review my points, my first point was that teacher is one of the three canonical offices of the New Testament church, and it is could also be called discipler or rabbi or shepherd. My second point is that Paul establishes early on a discipleship infrastructure carried out by teachers who in turn are materially and emotionally supported by the congregation. My third point was that ordination can become a fetish of legitimization, and we don't need to be hung up on that. We should be okay with recognizing. My fourth point is a person can fulfill multiple roles. And my fifth point is that the what of teaching or shepherding is no feed, protect, lead. I'm going to close here with an illustration, hopefully to motivate us. It's based on an effect that a lot of you have heard about. It's called the butterfly effect. So the butterfly effect is an effect that is from physics. It's from nonlinear physics. And basically it means that a small change in a system can produce a huge outcome over time and space. So the way that this is often described is a butterfly flaps its wings in China and there's a hurricane in Texas. Okay, so small effects in one place can get amplified over time through these nonlinear systems. This is a well-known effect in physics. And I'm gonna tell you a story here. I don't agree with the theology of these people, but that's okay. There's a lot to respect and admire about these individuals. Now, I'm guessing that nobody in the room has heard of Edward Kimball. I'm guessing not. Edward Kimball taught Sunday school in a small church right here in Boston. This was in the middle of the 19th century, in the mid-1800s. And he really wanted to be a good Sunday school teacher, but he felt like he was a failure. And the reason he felt like he was a failure is that some of the young men in his class would fool around in class or would fall asleep during class. And you know, if you have taught anything in front of people, it's not the greatest feeling when people are fooling around or falling asleep. And Kimball, this man, Edward Kimball, describes one boy in particular. He says, "I have seen few persons whose minds were spiritually darker than was his when he came into my Sunday school class. And I think that the committee of Mount Vernon Church seldom met an applicant for membership more unlikely ever to become a Christian of clear and decided views of gospel truth, still less to fill any extended sphere of public usefulness." Okay, so basically he's saying, this boy is in my class, we have no hope for him, the committee has no hope for him. But Edward Kimball goes on to says, after praying about the matter, he arranged to visit one of the students, this same student, at the boot store. I was determined to speak to him about Christ and about his soul and started down to Holton's boot store. When I was nearly there, I began to wonder whether I ought to go in just then during business hours. I thought the call might embarrass the boy, and that when I went away, the other clerks would ask who I was and taunt him with my efforts in trying to make him a good boy. It makes sense. Business hours, going in and interrupting him. In the meantime, I passed the store, and discovering this, this is from his journal, I determined to make a dash for it and to have it over at once. I found him in the back part of the building wrapping up shoes. I went up to him at once, and putting my hand on his shoulder, I made what I felt afterwards was a very weak plea for Christ. I don't know just what words I used, nor could he tell. I simply told him of Christ's love for him and the love Christ wanted in return. That's all there was. It seemed the young man was just ready for the light that then broke upon him. And there in the back of that store in Boston, who gave himself and his life to Christ? You all know who it is. D.L. Moody, of course. You've seen the plaque, I hope. It's right near Sattler. So Edward Kimball mustered up enough courage. I'm going to read you now D.L. Moody's description of Edward Kimball. Quote, "When I was in Boston, I used to attend a Sunday school class. And one day, my teacher came around behind the counter of the shop I was at work in and put his hand on my shoulder and talked to me about Christ and my soul. I had not felt I had a soul until then. I thought, this is a very strange thing. He is a man who never saw me until recently, and he is weeping over my sins. Oh, look at that key word there. He's crying. This man was crying over D.L. Moody here. And I had never shed a tear about them. But I understand it now and what it is to have a passion for men's souls and to weep over their sins. I don't remember what the man said, but I can feel the power of that man's hand on my shoulder tonight. Of course, D.L. Moody goes on to become one of the most famous preachers of the 1800s. And I'll read to you this little quote here from Moody. Where one man reads the Bible, 100 read you and me. That is what Paul means when we are to be living epistles, known and read of all men. If we do not commend the gospel to people by our holy walk and conversation, which means conduct, we shall not win them to Christ. Some little act of kindness will perhaps do more to influence them than any number of long sermons. Moody goes on, he only has a fifth grade education. He goes on to start 5 different educational institutions. Pretty impressive. Some in Illinois, some in Massachusetts. The story doesn't end. Moody preaches all over America and Europe and influences a British country preacher by the name of F.B. Meyer. F.B. Meyer then goes on a tour through the U.S., and he ends up influencing someone named Wilbur Chapman. Chapman becomes a powerful evangelist and ends up mentoring a baseball player whose name was Billy Sunday. Billy Sunday ends up quitting baseball to preach. In 1924, Billy Sunday has this huge influence in his speaking in Charlotte, North Carolina. Some people wanted Billy Sunday to come and preach to them, but he had some health issues, so he couldn't. So he pointed them to Mordecai Ham to instead hold a citywide crusade in Charlotte. The story doesn't end there. During one of the nights of this tent revival, a tall, lanky high school kid with wavy blonde hair named Billy comes into the tent. He accepts Christ that night. Want to guess Billy's last name? Billy Graham, right? And of course, most people would say he's preached to more people than anybody in history. Henry Brooks Adams said this, "A teacher affects eternity. He," and I'll say, "or she, can never tell where his influence ends." That's the butterfly effect there. Edward Kimball, none of us have heard of him. He had no idea the chain reaction that he was setting off with his tears. I think he was an excellent example of that biblical teaching ministry that was both macro and micro in the classroom, but also going one-on-one and visiting D.L. Moody there in his shoe store. It is hard work. You will be beat up, you will be discouraged, you will be criticized, but take heart. The Bible says in 1 Corinthians 15, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord."